so my research is on girl cartoons, television cartoons, particularly because I'm looking at popular culture. I find it to be very irresponsible that we don't really pay attention to mass media and how it affects society, seeing how it actually has such a wide reach. So I particularly paid attention to perhaps the most lowbrow art form we could, which is children's television. And then on top of that, I started to look at how it creates these normative codes, and I focused on gender coding. So my research was particularly on girl cartoons. And so exactly what it says there, what is that thing? I hope it leaves. Okay, so the playful transgressions of compulsive gender coding. And so can popular culture present counter-hegemonic tools from within the culture industry? So this idea that, you know, these normative codes are created within the culture industry, so can the culture industry itself create tools that can counter it? I don't know why that won't leave. It's there we go. Let's hope it stays off. So first you have to kind of define what is a girl cartoon, and it's somewhat problematic because, you know, defining a girl itself takes a very long time. But I defined it as a television program. So, and a girl has to be under 12 years old, so she's not a teenager or an adult. And because cartoons are this phantasmagoric art form, suspended disbelief allows the girl to be an anthropomorphized animal or even a toaster, like we do from The Brave Little Toaster. Cartoons themselves, when started off in theaters, which meant everybody was somewhat watching them. And Walter Benjamin described them as an art form that takes fragmentation and disintegration into its laws of form, making clear how constructed not only it is, but also the social world, ripe for transformation. And so what he's somewhat saying about this is like the use of this media form, cartoons, because they do these crazy things like ladybugs and now get a flower petal and drive it as a car, it's somewhat like, oh, you know, these things are constructed. And if that's this somewhat tool to then somewhat conceptualize how our social world is also a construct. So using the media to somewhat explain the concept of the construct, that's really hard for students, or at least it's how I sort of interrupted, that they don't even begin to question this. I give them The Matrix as another example. Look at The Matrix. You're in The Matrix. Sociology is your blue pill. You know, look, I realize that we created this system that we're in. So the cartoons was a mass media that was able to do this. And what it also did was challenge the elite ideas of art as private ownership. You know, he wrote Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction in the sense that this is now accessible to everyone. And so that was really changing. And it was adults and children alike. Disney, setting the master narrative, had been this expositional, even scientific function. It was very avant-garde with the early Mickey Mouse cartoons. But its first feature film, which was Snow White in 1937, introduced this realistically drawn narrative form. With it, it brought these moralistic values and sexual repression. So Disney becomes the normative code now for cartoons. So what we're doing is that we're creating, how do codes get created within our social norms? And in media, Disney somewhat established it. At this point, it had not been that way. So it setting this norm also then means we somewhat counter it. It's, oh, if you have this norm now, we can counter the norm, which is that duality, right, that gets established in structuralism. Oh, now that we have this, we can counter it with exactly this, as opposed to it being wider and open. So the young, demure, domesticated damsels versus the mature, sarcastic, sexy dames. So we call that the virgin whore duality. And that becomes now the genre of how these representations start to exist. So cartoons and just general films, television gets created now, goes into TV, and if Disney creates the master narrative of cartoons in the theater, it's Hanna-Barbera who creates it in television. And by 1992, out of the 8,400 television cartoon characters that Hanna-Barbera had created, which is quite a bit, not a single one had been a lead girl or a lead woman. They didn't have it. So years later, they were asked, it's not like these aren't bad guys, you know, they're cartoonists, they're cool, they're cute nerds. They're just like right on, and they're like, oh, it just never occurred to us. You know, very simple. And it's like, why didn't it ever occur to you? Because the industry practice was that a girl will watch, a boy won't watch a girl cartoon, but a girl will watch a boy cartoon. And so this is somewhat put into practice as such. And so this is in the 1980s, Reagan it takes away the regulations for television. And amongst the removing the fairness doctrine and amongst the other things, he also says that children's television doesn't have to be regulated. And it opens the gates for toy-based cartoons. So toy companies start to hire animation companies to produce, you know, 150 episodes all at once, which is why they were such low quality, of a toy that already existed. In essence, they were half-hour commercials for He-Man or Transformers or Rainbow Bride or Strawberry Shortcake. So because the toy industry itself was very divisible in the gender binary, that now gets translated to the media of cartoons. The gender binary now gets creating this genre. The very interesting part about it is that it's the first time now that there's a girl cartoon. Although it's a commercially motivated movement, it's not like, we should do something for the girls. No. We should do something to make money from the girls. Yes, that was the intention. So even though there's this capitalist imperative for profit directive, it still then opened the door to what I call this room of one's own for little girls that had not existed prior to this point. And though it was criticized as being very pink and rainbowish, it still had a little girl lead. She wasn't the sidekick. She wasn't being rescued by the boys. So I wrote a paper about these girl cartoons of the 1980s that no one ever addresses this as the originators of girl power. Girl power was somewhat addressed in the 1990s. That's when it became a lexicon for us and a tribute to, like, the Spice Girls and stuff like that. And it didn't matter in girl power how old you were, but it did matter how young you were. Girl power wasn't for little girls. And so what we weren't paying attention to was if in the 90s we were establishing girl power and it kind of started with adolescents and teenagers, those girls who are now tying their feminist empowerment to consumer consumption actually were the little kids of the 1980s that were watching these cartoons that are already tying this gender identity empowerment to consumption. So that had already started to occur. So these are the originals girl power representation. So what I do and what I use here with this is somewhat to show, look, this genre has a beginning. How it is that we try to establish that through these things that you get, that somewhat then symbolizes your empowerment. It has a point of origin. And that's somewhat important also to show to students because they don't really put into perspective of like, oh, this is the way it is. Like, well, the way it is somewhat started somewhere. So you somewhat show how this genre got into existence. Part of one of the things that I figured out by watching literally hundreds of cartoon episodes, it was like, that there was a pretty consistent, what I was calling a thorn in the side of the empowerment of the girl. I called it the mean girls and the misogyny and the no homo boy. The misogyny boy and the no homo boy are these boys. The misogyny boy is this boy that like hates the girls. No girls are allowed. Oh, you're a girl. You can't do that. And that was always present. And if it wasn't him, it was then what I was calling the no homo boy. If you're not familiar with the term no homo, what it is, it's like when guys are like, oh, I like those shorts on you. No homo is like, let me not be mistaken. And for homosexual, I'd like to reinstate that I'm a heterosexual man, you know. So that idea of what it actually means is that I cannot show friendship to another man. I might be homosexual, but also I cannot appreciate things that are feminine. So the no homo boy character, if he likes something that's girly or girlish or for girls, he has to pretend that he doesn't like it. And then it's then the joke, like, oh, he's playing with the little pony. It's like, gross, I don't know that, as soon as he gets caught. So this was pretty persistent, and as well as the mean girl then. So now you have this empowered girl character, then there'll be this secondary girl character who's essentially a snob or a brat or mean, and she's into peer rivalry, and what she then does, it's somewhat other the main character. So you have this empowered girl character that's somewhat challenging the way that we represent girls as somewhat, you know, an inferior gender category. But so then you and here she is empowered. But if you introduce this mean girl character, what you're then representing is the normative codes of girl. And so what it does is that it makes the lead girl into an other, an exception, something that's rare, because here's the what girls really are like. So these two plot devices were persistently present through almost every single cartoon that I watched. It was continuously used. And it's funny because once I somewhat bring it up, people then start watching shows like, oh yeah, there it is. It's just a matter of time. It's like the writers don't know what to do and they instantly throw this out there. Here's an example of a misogyny boy. So it's Rainbow Bright, and it's called the Star Stealers. And they've got to go rescue someone in a castle or something. He goes, that dumb horse of yours can't help rescue us. He can't even fly without your color belt. And she goes, he can think, which is more than your horse can do. So I use that as the indicative of the struggle that girls and women face when we're devalued through, you know, our physical prowess, but we prove ourselves through our intellectual accomplishments. And in girl cartoons, the misogyny boy is the girl's reminder of the sexism that she faces in daily life, and that's the hegemony. But it's also a reminder of how she can outsmart it. and that's the counter-hegemony. So this is your examples of how these counter-hegemonic potential themes somewhat exist from the very creators of it. It's almost as if they don't even really know that it's happening. I'm calling it under the radar is how I refer to these movements. When Clinton comes into office, he reinforces FCC codes, and all those cartoons leave the air, and with it, all girl cartoons leave the air. Rainbow Bright was the last one. 1988 was the last time there was a girl cartoon. And cable TV then introduces these two stations, Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network, both focus on cartoons pretty specifically, and they rise up. It's interesting, Nickelodeon had been run by a man, the man who somewhat coined the phrase, boys won't watch girl cartoons, but girls will watch boy cartoons. Under his leadership, Nickelodeon was the lowest rating station. He gets replaced by a woman, Geraldine Laybourne, who later on went on to revamp the Disney Channel, and then she ran the Oxygen Channel for Oprah. And under her leadership, within 3 months, she had raised Nickelodeon to the number one rated station on cable television. So this woman power somewhat exists within both these stations because it was women who were in the executive positions of both, and yet there were no girl cartoons. They had started in 1991 and 1992, and it wasn't until 1998 that we got our first girl cartoon back on television. So there had been a 10-year hiatus of no girl cartoons on television in the United States. I'm very United States-specific in my research. So they make history, not just by bringing little girl cartoons back, but by being the first superhero girls. There were no superhero little girls. There's teenagers. There are no girls. And so the reason that this is important is because you can see that, you know, She-Ra is ready for her porno shoot, and Wonder Woman is a dominatrix, and Batgirl is given relationship drama pretty consistently throughout the show. So what it did by making these little girl superheroes that were like in kindergarten, you couldn't put them in heteronormative relationship, and you couldn't sexualize them. Of course you can, but it wasn't happening in the show. And so this idea of presenting these characters where that wasn't being able to happen somewhat freed them and freed their power to be able to exist outside of that situation. As a result of them being successful, they then opened the floodgates for girl cartoons to come into the air. And Nickelodeon, that was Cartoon Network, Powerpuff Girls. So Nickelodeon makes its first girl cartoon, which is Dora the Explorer. Dora is incredibly important. It's not easy to understate how important she is or overstate how important she is, because she's 7 years old. She's Spanish bilingual. So she speaks Spanish, and she's this proactive, motivational leader. And her sidekick is Boots, who's a monkey, not a little bunny or a little chick. And the monkey within the southern hemispheres of the world is a very mythical creature in Africa, in Asia, in South America. There's Monkey King or Monkey Emperor, the monkey, the trickster, there's a god. So this character is kind of important. It's her little sidekick. And so what Dora does is that she's not didactic in the way that she challenges gender normative coding. She very much does it through playful transgressions. And I put there the cover of three of the DVDs that she has for sale. So in the season one, she has this episode of Dora Saves the Prince. It's Dora who actually goes to rescue the prince from the tower. It's the opposite of Rapunzel. And she's very cool about it. She's not saying girls can do it. She just does it. And she's a pirate, you know, because we've always established that this has to be a boy's costume thing, but Dora dresses up like a pirate kind of often. Here she's a detective, so she's somewhat using these tools that, again, we associate as boys' games. So it's Dora that somewhat does it. What's pretty fascinating about Dora, too, is that she's such a cool cartoon character that little boys were loving Dora as a cartoon and wanted to purchase Dora products. And while it was okay for little boys to watch the Dora cartoon, it was not okay for little boys to have Dora backpacks and Dora sneakers and Dora pencil cases. So they had to create Diego, Dora's cousin, in order to have a product for the little boys to somewhat consume. He wasn't as successful. He's cool, though, too, and they made him darker skinned. So I think they did all right by Diego as well. So with the Powerpuff Girls and Dora the Explorer, what it does is, like, it opens the doors now. Now little girl cartoons starting to become more popular, and now they're on every station. Now they start to exist. They're starting to proliferate. But of course, now that this movement starts to exist, there's a counter movement to it. And so what we see is that the culture industry starts to resist this idea of little girl empowerment, because it has been so established as this code that little girls aren't supposed to have that position. They don't know how to handle it. So you can see in this that Lilo and Stitch comes out, which was an extremely profitable film. The next CD that comes out, they totally removed Lilo's name from the title,
And in this third one, they actually cross it out, like she's all upset. Like, why did you cross out my name? They just totally got rid of her. They left her in there, but it was this idea of, like, why would little boys want to see Lilo and Stitch? Little boys want Stitch. Little boys want Stitch. And it's like, little boys love Lilo, too. But they wanted to make this into a boys' cartoon, so they actively removed Lilo from at least the presentation of it. And so what I wanted to look at was, like, how is it that the culture industry then counters the counter-hegemony as it exists? And so I have some examples of it that are very sad to somewhat look at, because what they do is that they take these girl characters and they revamp them as thinner, they make them a little bit older, and essentially what they're trying to do is make them sexy. You can see with Rainbow Bright, she becomes, you know, anorexic, actually, you know, and blonde, and she goes from being a little girl to being a preteen. You can see how they do it with these other characters, how they somewhat change the image, somewhat suit this, oh, this is what little girls are supposed to be like. This is the one that's more sad for me. The quote that they came out with was, older girls enjoy fashion doll play. It's the, this new version will capture girls' existing love of Dora and marry it with the love of fashion, allowing them to change Dora's hair length, jewelry, and even her eye color. It's like, changing someone's eye color is an attempt to change someone's ethnicity. So this is what they're somewhat going for. And they were somewhat saying, she's still an explorer, she's exploring on the internet for shopping. This was the intention, was they were trying to sell products to girls on the Dora the Explorer website of makeup and jewelry. Because they're older now. So here's another phrase I coined, if you can believe I just published an article with boobs and boyfriends as a phrase, which is what they do as soon as little, all these girls are under the age of 12, they're 11 years old and under. As soon as these girls turned 12, it was formulaic that they would get boobs and a boyfriend. They had to have this heteronormative romantic interest that immediately occurs as they reach this age, and they had to have a shapely body. Look at Supergirl's outfit, because she doesn't need to dress like that. Why are you giving her a miniskirt? It's really not practical if you're a superhero. You should be wearing pants. And why are you cutting Kim Possible's shirt off to show a midriff? And as told by Ginger, the whole show is all about, you know, little girl drama of, like, does that boy like me? Does he have a crush on me? And as soon as she breaks up with one boy, it was another one. All the seasons were pretty much wrapped up in that. And this is the one that was most sad for me, because I watched this when I was a little kid. I loved Inspector Gadget. I guess I wasn't so little. But you can see that she becomes a member of the Aryan Nation as soon as they revamp it. They change her ethnic identity to try to make her more blonde. They cut off her shirt. And what's also very interesting is that in the original, she's a techie. She uses a communicator. This is before cell phones. And a computer book, and it's before laptops. So she was a techie. And so they changed that in the new version by giving her these two robots. Uncle Gadget becomes the Gadgetinis, and they do all the tech stuff. So she's no longer a techie. She just does these movements of fighting. But they're trying to, sex her up? And so then when you get to the video games, now she has boobs. Immediately, it's like, oh, here the steps, how it somewhat evolves. Disney did this to Merida, and it got a lot of... people criticized it a lot. So Disney's, the statement was, no, we're not. Merida exemplifies what it means to be a Disney princess. Her inner qualities of brave, passion, and confidence remains the same, inspiring moms and daughters around the world to hate their bodies. Because what we're trying to do is look at the very subtle differences. It's not a big deal. But when you put them next to each other, you can see that they're sexualizing this body. They try to make a curve. They lower the hemline. They make the hair different. And she really did go from this, like, teenager girl that's protesting being put into a forced marriage and wants to be independent into someone who is, you know, incredibly sexy and showing off her body and using sex as her weapon. She didn't use sex as a weapon. She used her bow and arrow as a weapon. So what we look at is when we try to talk about this counter-hegemonic potential is like, well, what about counterculture? What about the movements that are directly opposed to the hegemony as it exists? And can we be the agents of change against the culture industry while actively being its consumers and fans? And alternative oppositional culture is often ironic by its design, its resistance. So the question was for me, like, can it be alternative or even oppositional if the culture industry populars consumption, the way that we consume it, gets refunctioned instead of actually the product itself? And I discovered the bronies. And so the bronies is a fan base of the new My Little Pony cartoon. And it's predominantly male. It's also predominantly white. And they're, you know, they're not children. They're like teen, high school, college, guys.
And their motto is love and tolerance, these guys. So I've been going to their conventions. I had to apply for an IRB. Carmen knows all about this. It took a lot of work. Interviewing these guys, like, what are you up to? Who are you? Why do you like this cartoon? And it's pretty much just what you would think of just regular guys, Comic-Con nerds, essentially. Just, you know, we could like Star Wars, but we like the ponies. And this idea of, like, because they are challenging this gender coding by enjoying something that is supposed to be for girls, and they're not doing it with any kind of irony. It is very sincere, their love. And what it has done is somewhat create these guys that by the very essence of being fans of this has given them this avenue to challenge social norms. And it's a group of people that maybe actually don't really have access to those tools, who normative white heterosexual men have found a way to be counter-hegemonic. And it's amazing how this fandom has continued to grow. The first group was here in Chinatown. It was 100 people. 6 months later, it was 300 people. Then they met again. They had to get a hotel room. There was 800 people. By the time they had their first convention, there was 4,000 people. The following year, it went to 8,000. And last year, it was 9,600. I haven't had the count for this year yet, but I heard it was more than 11,000 people. So this population continue. This is just who goes to the convention. They are represented in practically every single country of the world. There's a brony logging group that you can somewhat. China just opened up, and in the first day, in the first week of existing, they had 40,000 people in China log in to register themselves as bronies. So this group is somewhat representing something very interesting that happens within capitalism, which is that, let me see if I actually said that. So Walter Benjamin, when he talks about cartoons, he goes, they refunction the apparatus of popular culture production. So these smart, heroic leaders of television girl cartoons have done this by playfully transgressing the compulsive gender normative coding in popular culture production. The bronies, by refunctioning the apparatus of popular culture consumption, are this example of the counter-hegemonic potential from within the industry. So how does the industry regain its control? How does it make it normal again when these people are somewhat challenging it? And so what Hasbro did was make a new group called the Equestria Girls. And instantly what they did was give them all boobs and give them boyfriends, which does not exist in the My Little Pony cartoon. So these girls, as soon as their bodies get sexualized, like they do in the Equestria Girl, they're then placed into heteronormative romantic relationship with boys. And by contrast, when the characters' bodies are not sexualized, like in My Little Pony, the girl and boy characters are friends. And like the show states, My Little Pony, friendship is magic. That's not a tagline for Equestria Girls. It's in My Little Pony. So it's somewhat an important thing to know on how that's different. So this is what I was saying. Subculture groups, when they exist, they create new social movements, and visual styles are then associated with these new social movements. So corporations appropriate these movements and these styles in order to keep current so that they can continue to make profits. So it's the capitalist imperative, it's such that audiences, like the bronies, they may be active agents in the creation of meaning, but the market, Hasbro, it doesn't allow for that meaning to further develop before it can repackage and commodify it by removing dissent. The problem is that Hasbro can't do that to the bronies. They don't know how to do it to the bronies. They haven't been able to remove the dissent of this community because they don't really understand how it even exists, because it's not by irony. And the bronies are not they themselves intentionally trying to counter. They are just liking something. So for the past 5 years, Hasbro has just kind of closed its eyes to their existence and pretends that they don't exist, while they continue to grow. And what is happening is that then this subculture is then appropriating the industry as opposed to the reverse. So these dolls, like the kinds I'm showing you here, are becoming for sale quite everywhere, actually. I've been seeing them in shops. Before, it was only on Etsy and in the conventions, but they're pretty popular. So this one's my favorite because it's My Little Pony taking on Rainbow Bright, you know, Lady Gaga, you know, Kill Bill, if you can see the way it goes around. So the bronies' mantra of love and tolerance, it's actively enacting a new commons of a group, that it isn't hierarchical and it isn't exploitative. So the bronies defy the social convention and conformism simply by identifying as consumers of a popular culture media product that's intended to be consumed by young girls, which is innately heretical. So, yet they connect through BonyCon. And what this means is, like, these aren't people that are outsiders or different or they don't want to be part of the social world. They very much are part of the social world and prove that they're very social within it. So, So what was the cultural ventriloquism aspect of it was that when different subcultures somewhat exist, like the skateboarding culture, that was anarchist. Skateboarders were anarchists, and they would get arrested all the time. Skateboarding's not a crime. That was a big deal. And so what happened was how they started to create a style. And so the industry, fashion and products, took over that style, but it removed its dissent in order to sell it. Mm-hmm. So you can buy all kinds of skateboarding culture products now, but they're not about being an anarchist or being a rebel. They're actually just about being stylish now. So it's the formula, it's a really clear formula of like how to remove dissent from the aspect that, that they have not been able to do with the brony. How am I doing on time? I'm okay? You got it? Should I do this one?
Yeah, you can wrap it up.
Okay, this is the part two of it, but I'll talk extra fast. The last thing I was doing most recently was I'm trying to see what's the representation of the princess that's the problem, because the master narrative that got created, particularly with Disney, it became a movement about 10 years ago, was this Disney princess. They started to lump all the princesses together, and it was this illusion of difference starting to exist, and we start to see it in all the somewhat of toys. Oh, you have so many choices, but you really don't have so many choices. It's actually just a, very much the same thing that continues to get represented. So I tried to find someone that's creating princesses that's very different, and this cartoon Adventure Time exists that creates these princess narratives that completely counter the master narrative form. It's a skewed, a queer femininity. It's, if you can see there, it's hot dog princess, slime princess, muscle princess. The princess demonstrate this monster beauty, which is a term we use to talk about women that are kind of like outside the normative definitions of beauty. So it fabricates and executes an image that destabilizes the hegemony of beauty. And so using something like the princess to undo a tool of a princess seems somewhat like a paradox, but it's actually quite effective when it starts to get put into place. Twilight Sparkle looks exactly like a princess, but the way that she somewhat counters it is by always saying, I don't want to be treated differently. I'd like to, you know, I'm not different from you just because I'm a princess now. You know, I'm still the same, and don't treat me special. So she is somewhat showing what a princess actually is, which is a leader. Nickelodeon came out with the new Avatar The Last Airbender. Avatar gets reincarnated. The new reincarnation was a girl instead of a boy, how it had been originally. And she was then a spiritual leader. So this redefinition of like what a princess actually is a strong and powerful leader, which is what you'd think that you know, a princess would be. Not just like, oh, la 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 la, where's my, you know, na na. This new princess just came out. It's in its first season. And she's Disney. So I found this fascinating. My nieces turned me on to it. I just saw it actually last week. It's in its first season. It's Star versus the Forces of Evil. And when I went to BronyCon, they had told me about it because the bronies got the finger on the pulse. So she's still thin and blonde. So we still got that going on. But she's 14 years old, but she doesn't have boobs, if you'll notice. And she doesn't have a boyfriend. So she has this boy. They even have this episode where they dance together in something that was of a romantic spell. And instead she got mad at him and said, hey, I don't need somebody to take care of me. I can take care of myself. I just need a friend. And I was like, whoa, that's so amazing that she actually said that. So she still has that going on. And I say for now, because it's in its first season. So what Disney is doing is that it's countering its own master narrative. And we saw it with Maleficent and Frozen. Frozen did the true love kiss, you know, and that was in Maleficent, and it was Maleficent's kiss that actually brought the princess awake. And in Frozen, it was like only true love, and it's like, oh, her boyfriend tried to thaw her and it didn't work, and it was her true love for her sister that saw her own heart. So the master narrative that was created by the culture industry of Disney, it's Disney who's undoing its own master narrative, and I haven't really been able to figure it out exactly, but I think it's because there have been these women executives who have entered these positions of power. And why this is actually important is because there's still these major genres like DC and Marvel who, when they create women superheroes that are in power position, they don't make them as important as the men, and they still somewhat sexualize them. And Paul Dini, who actually creates a lot of these cartoons, was saying that's exactly what they told them. That the executives told them, we need boys, but we need girls right there, a step behind the boys. Not as equal to the boys. There, but it, not as important. And when you saw the Lego movie, there was only two characters, and one was Unikitty that was hysterical, or Wildstyle, who was always obsessed about her boyfriend Batman and really into it. And these were the only girl characters in the show. Everything else was a boy. It was a really good cartoon, except for that representation. And so what we're seeing, that change actually is happening, and it's very, this is one of the best examples that we had had before, women voice boy characters, but it's now happening that we're having men voice women characters, and not in an ironic, funny way, like the lunch lady on The Simpsons was a man, but this is an actual girl characters and women characters being voiced by male actors. So this change is what I was telling the bronies. We do it together by actively, you know, teaching and watching and producing, and that's it. And do you want to do like all three of us in a row and then Q&A after?
Just to make sure that everyone gets a chance to speak,
okay.
And then we can have lots of questions later.
Okay.
So, okay, our next speaker is Ashiza Shah from the Department of English.
I don't think I'm as thorough as taught here, but I'm going to try. Okay. What I'm taking into a section where basically I'm talking about, I'll discuss graphic novels and comic books, a bit of history, and really my theme was identity, and identity in graphic novels and comic books, and thinking about it, trying to explore what, I read up so much on it, researching, it is huge. The legacy of comic books and graphic novels with this theme, it explores it on all facets of it. It has done that. It's been history. It began with that. So trying to narrow it down, and I finally did, and what struck me about graphic novels, why do they speak to me? And what I found with an important part of what they do about identity, and many times they're so either on, they're right where society needs to be or ahead of society. In very progressive thinking. That's really what the point is the progressive thinking about it, of identity, that is so attractive and amazing and so brilliant about these works of art, and they are works of art. Right now, as I'm teaching my classes, I am working with graphic novels with them, and one of the major points that I keep on bringing out to them is you accept these are works of literature. They have risen to that level now. So particularly a graphic novel like Watchmen, you would... Clearly, it has risen to that level. But getting back to the theme of identity, well, what does it mean? For me, when I think of identity and the role that the graphic novels play with that theme, is that what we see in mainstream society or mainstream media, it is always apparent that as far as identity is concerned, the graphic novel world, it is the humanizing of people, especially people who are minority figures, who are ostracized, marginalized. That is it's almost paradoxical, because what are graphic novels usually known for? These bigger-than-life characters, these amazing costumes and the way they look and so fit and healthy, and yet it's what the tremendous role that they play in their contribution to this theme is that they humanize these characters through metaphor, of course, but that's what they're doing. Now, a lot of the interesting thing about, and I just want to digress a bit with some history there, is that with the inception and we've started with characters like Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and with them they. It's almost amazing how their lives even parallel so much of this, is that when they started off, they wanted to be writers, and they were artists and cartoonists, and they could not find work in this society simply because they're Jewish. And so they were not able to find employment. And so they had nowhere else to go but to this industry. This industry was the only one that was willing to take them in. And so through my research and everything, a lot of writers and scholars have found that there's no question that that sense of being Jewish and a group that has experienced marginalization, and that theme trickled into their work. There was no question about it. It's been found. Superman, the outsider, the dream.
X-Men.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. So it's gone over, I always found that parallel so interesting, that even the inception of this work comes from a place where the creators were people who understood what it meant to be put to the side, stereotyped, and attacked for being different. And so that legacy has been consistent throughout these works. And so what their contribution to identity, as I said, is the humanizing. And so what does it mean to humanize, and what is it that they're fighting against? It's basically the stereotyping that is done through mainstream media, really. That's what they've always been trying to counter. And that's what has always... And they served a tremendous purpose for and contribution to these groups. Groups such as Native Americans, who were once depicted as savages, African Americans and Hispanics, depicted as violent, Asian Americans, who were depicted as shifty businessmen with thick accents. These things were always in the mainstream media. You'd find in the graphic novel world that they were countering them with all variety, all complexity of what it means to human was being presented here. And this kind of, this legacy of theirs continues with, in the 1960s with the civil rights movement, with the, as you said, the X-Men, the creation of the X-Men, where, Stan Lee specifically, he said this, that he wanted to create a group where he wanted a place in this. He wanted to do a contribution to this fight. And so creating the X-Men, you have a group of people who have a genetic trait that they have no control over, but because of it, they are vilified, they are subjected to violence, they are basically being quarantined, separated. So to do that and to... Then what does he do? Through metaphor, creates characters like Dr. Xavier and, of course, Magneto, where Dr. Xavier was representing the philosophies of Martin Luther King, and Magneto is the fiery Malcolm X. So this struggle was right there. As I was thinking about it, the tremendous courage that it took these writers to go against the grain, to go against society, it can't be underestimated, especially at those times, and what they were willing to subject themselves to for the sake of this is heroic, lack of a better word. It is heroic. It is that what they've done, and I see this parallel going throughout the whole. As I was researching all of this, who are the heroes here? Isn't these characters or the people who are doing this? It was just a tremendous respect for them after all this reading about them. And so, and they're continuing with this legacy, which sort of, to me, is a bit, touches my heart, is that, once again, they did it, and sticking by that legacy is with people of Middle Eastern descent, and those who are, I guess, observant of the Islamic faith. This is the new group that is suffering tremendous stereotyping, caricature throughout the media, vilified, that it's rampant. We can't even get away with it. Just even yesterday, you heard Ben Carson, and they're giving him so much money for his statement about Muslims and everything. And so, with that in mind, it's remarkable that, again, graphic novels came to the rescue, if you will, where they create characters who go completely against the grain, who are not these caricatures, but completely flawed, yet great and amazing, and struggle with all the elements that mean to be human. Now, the one that was really interesting and... And telling was in 2011, where DC introduced a French Batman, basically, and named him Bilal Asali, an Algerian Muslim French citizen who became the Batman of France. His story highlighted the problems in France, especially in the area where the riots happened, and really explored their story. So they created this character, and the backlash that they got was tremendous. Mm-hmm. It was very disheartening, to say the least. The DC had to come up and actually a press conference to justify it, but the vitriol was humongous, where people, you know, right-winger neo-Nazis coming out, talking about it. One would say something like, well, we all know, but there's no way you can make a hero a Muslim because we all know they're born like that. You know, they're born like terrorists, and you can't do that. And really meant it. So, but again, rising up to that legacy of the progressive thinking of Kirby, back to that, they stood up to it. They were willing to risk the revenue. They were willing to risk the fans because they were not going to go along with this. They were not going to give in. They were going to continue their voice of dissent and let the character go through. And when they spoke to the creator of the character of this French Batman, the creator, the artist simply said, I know what a hero is. And for me, a hero is someone who rises up out of a situation where they are, someone is being subjugated, mistreated, denied rights that any other human being deserves. And somewhere from that world, someone rises up. And for me, the place that seemed, he's a French artist, right? For me, when I look at my world, I find this is the area where I need the hero to come from. And that's why I chose it, and I am refused to back down to anybody. And he continued with it. And now we have, with Marvel, Kamala, the new Miss Marvel. She's great. I like her, the teenager, dealing with, she's a Pakistani Muslim, and she's struggling with typical teenage girl issues, really. And coming from a conservative family, so by day she's a teen, by night she's Miss Marvel, wonderful. The backlash, again, came through with, of course, you can't do that, why would you do that? From something as, and then all the way up to Conan O'Brien making that ridiculous joke with saying something, Marvel is coming up with a new Muslim superhero. She has, turns out she has powers that her husband's other wives don't have. Yeah. Okay. Which completely, the fact that the girl is only 16 years old and she's really an American citizen, identifies herself as an American. But all that, and also that whole thing of arranged marriages with four or five women, whatever, it's such a small group that even does, or even can, do that. That was totally forgotten for the sake of the joke. So this is what they have to contend with. But the heroic part of it, the remarkable contribution to the theme of identity, and so timely. Once again, if not where society should be, but definitely at the forefront of society, ahead of this theme, is right here in this world of graphic novels. Where once again, they're playing the heroes. Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker will be Patrick Hickey from the Journalism and Print Media Program.
And the English Department.
And the English Department, yes. Okay.
Seen everywhere.
Yes. Okay, so the last couple of presentations were fantastic. The research is definitely there. What I'm trying to do, essentially, is I'm going to introduce you guys to a text that you may not have seen before. And I want to just talk about how it can be used in different classes. And how... That's not good. That's not what I wanted to do. And how it can be used in English 12 class, how it could be used in English 24 class, how it could be used in a 30, a 40... Because I remember I was having a conversation with Professor Xiao one day, and she was saying something along the lines of, graphic novels are the myths of today. So we have our students study Hercules and all of these things. What's graphic novels are essentially the same exact thing, you know? So as soon as this boots up, and it's not there, that's not good. All right, just give me 1 second, guys. I'm sorry. So I'll talk a little bit about the text first. So it's Resident Alien. It's by Peter Hogan. It's a Dark Horse comic. When we discuss, and we could have some back and forth here. I don't have to, like, take over the entire stage. When we're kind of pitching a story to our chairperson that you want to use for your class, what are the things that you're looking for? Anybody? Depth. Right? A message. right? Something different than just something that the reader can, something the student can glean from, so to speak, right? So what if I was to tell you that this graphic novel has a theme, okay, that has elements of noir in it, okay, that makes odes to pop culture, that makes the reader have a knowledge base before they go into the reading, that they can't just go, oh, I'm going to read a comic book and just go in, that they actually benefit from knowing more about the world than they know more about the world before they go in, and they'll know more about the world after. Isn't that the same effect that a good story has on you? So in 24, kind of like the placeholder reading, so to speak, is Oliver Sacks' Anthropologist on Mars. You begin teaching English 12 in Kingsborough, and it's like, that's the safe choice, yeah. Right? And why do we like Oliver Sacks? Because what is that story really about? Come on, my English teachers, help me. What is it about? Adaptability?
Yes.
It's a coming of age. All of them are coming of age stories, right?
And it's a great, compelling story. And
absolutely.
It's a storyteller.
You're not bored reading it. That's the first thing. And then two, it kind of shows us that anyone is capable of anything, regardless of where they come from. It's definitely a story of outsiders. You know, you have a Turetic surgeon, a surgeon that's Turetic that is unique, to say the least. And people judge him based on the way that he acts, but the more they get to know him, the more they connect with him. So, Resident Alien, as you guys can see, like, I'm sorry that it's watermarked. It's actually a review copy that I got, so there's going to be watermarks on the photos. But, he's an alien that crash lands on Earth, okay? And he has the ability where he can almost, he can project himself to be seen any way that he wants to be seen. So he actually makes himself a retired doctor in a small town in the United States. And he's retired. So all he does, he has a little cabin, and all he does is fish all day. So he's completely safe. So, and they give, like, the background of the story, and it's really cute, like, he crash lands, and he's like, oh my god, like, what do? I have no idea what to do. So he, like, jimmies a ATM, gets, like, a ton of money, buys a little house, a little cabin, and then, like, starts his life. And he's really bored because he's all by himself, and he doesn't know how to communicate with anyone. He learns the language, okay? He starts reading detective novels. Agatha Christie, you know, James Cain, all of these noir stories, and he falls in love with American society and humanity. And he, after a while, he doesn't necessarily forget about his family, but he becomes enthralled by humanity, and he kind of wants to reach out, but he's petrified. So what eventually happens is the doctor in the town, what do we think happens to the doctor in the town?
Death.
Yeah. So they come to him and they're like, oh, you're a doctor. Harry Vanderspiegel. It's like the worst name in the world, right? But it's like, oh, you know, doctor, we need you to kind of step up. And he loves like Law and Order and all these detective stories and all ER, all these shows. He's like entrenched in pop culture. He is like a brony in a way. Mm-hmm. Like he loves these things that aren't, he's an alien. He's not supposed to be infatuated with this culture. It's outside to him. And yet, for no reason other than it's interesting to him and he's enthralled by it, he becomes captivated by it. So, he becomes a member of this society. And he is a beloved member of this community. So this is the way he naturally is, but they cannot see him as that. They see him as an older man, and he has friends, and he actually, in a way, slowly becomes a permanent fixture in the society, and he's also, because of his love of Agatha Christie and crime novels and stuff, he starts trying to look for clues to find out who killed the doctor. And then what happens is another person dies. And then another person dies. And all of a sudden, he's hot on the trail. But something goes wrong, for him at least, that his nurse, she knows something's up. She knows he's not right. That there's something different about this guy, and she just can't put her nose on it. She can't. And it's kind of ironic that there's like a bit of a stereotype there that she's a Native American, and her father tells her, you know, you're on the right path. He's not like what he appears to be, but it doesn't matter. Don't look into it. He's a good guy. Okay? So, think about it. We're trying to get our students to think outside the box, right? to say it's okay to be different, right? This is extremely visual, okay? The language is just as complex, probably not as Oliver Sacks, but some of the other stories that you've had your students read in English 12, it's just as complex. They will have to use a dictionary at times, okay? So, which would make it great for a remedial class, too, because you want to build up that vocabulary, right? But it's just good-looking. It looks good. So, like I said, too, there are scenes when he goes to the library, and he wants to read. He loves to read. And how many times have we been in an English 24 class, and like, who's your favorite author? And it's like, I don't like to read. I'm teaching in English 40 right now, where it's writing intensive, and the first day, it's like, what's your name? What's your major? Who's your favorite author? And they're like, we're just taking the class because it's writing intensive. And I'm like, this is an English 40 class. You're supposed to love to read. And they're like, yeah, no. So I mentioned Chekhov, and they're like, who? Isn't that guy on Star Trek? Like, they have no idea who Anton Chekhov is. So that first week is always rough. The first week of the semester, right? You're like, you guys have to get these books. And they go, oh, man. And have you guys seen the bookstore? It's a madhouse, right? It's like Jingle All the Way, like with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it's like you're clawing to get through. So if you have these books on PDF, you can just say, guys, give me your email address. I'll send it to you. Read it for tonight. Come in the next day. 160, 170 pages. It's going to take them 45 minutes, an hour to read it. So it's not a joke. Okay? And they're going to get something out of it. So Dial M for Murder, like, if you don't know what Dial M for Murder is, I tell my students all the time, if they're making a reference to something that you don't know, what do? You look it up. You research. English 24, what is that class? It's a research-based class. You know? So we can use a book like this in an English 24 class. But also, too, in a short fiction environment, like English 30 or English 40. English 40, what do you have to do? You have to mix up. No, English 30, you have to kind of mix it up, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, it could be like poetry, drama, short fiction, right? So why can't graphic novels be one of those genres that you represent, you know? And this is just, it's a great story. It's well written, okay? So like I said, he's an amateur detective. So it's like, the best stories are kind of like, you guys ever see Grease before? I hope so. John Travolta's dancing, and he throws the lasso out. It's an imaginary lasso, but Olivia Newton-John comes, right? When he goes like this, right? This is doing the same exact thing. Because the reader, even though they may not connect with Harry in the beginning, it's cool because it's a movie that crash lands. And then when the story starts to heat up and they're making all these pop culture references and they feel the noir, they'll start to come along and they're like, I like stories like this. And it becomes so much more than just a comic book. It becomes something that they have to get to the end of. Okay? All right. So you need another reason to use something like this? I mean, it's incredibly engaging. The art is great. I mean, Harry at one point is literally like fighting for his life. Okay, so this is the nurse. She ends up like becoming like his sidekick in a way. So during the day, they're treating like the townsfolk, and then at night, Harry's trying to find out who the killer is, and she's like, listen, I'm not letting you go out by yourself. You're an old man. So it's great, you know? And meanwhile, he's this incredibly intelligent, strong alien. Okay? And like I said to you, visually stunning. Okay? 164 pages, but it has a meaning, it's clear, it's easy to understand, but there's plenty of room to dissect and guide your students. It's not just a comic book. There's too many people that look at this material and say, it's silly, it's a comic book, blah, blah, blah. We can have a conversation, too, in a health class about alcoholism. That always happens, right? You could read something like Wild Rover, where the artist and the writer wrote it because he himself was dealing with alcoholism, you know? So it's like I've interviewed the author, like Michael Oeming, and he talks about like he had all these demons on in his mind and he just put it down on paper. So it could get as complex as that, or it could just be a really good story that has room to pull and guide. You could take these lessons in any way that you want. So it's just a different way to teach, but then also too, it's a more enjoyable way to teach too. Instead of using the same text every semester, I mean, it gets boring. You know, and if your students see that you're engaged, then they're going to be engaged too. So, that's it. Okay? Okay.
Well, thanks to all the speakers. We do have time. If people have questions, we...
Does the alien like the whole comic?
Yes. Well, through the first three trades. They're on the fourth trade now.
And it's like now he's kind of like in this dilemma of Asta is the woman's name, the nurse. He wants to, it's the wrong terminology, but he wants to come out to Asta. He wants to share that with her. And she already knows, and she'll never mention it to him. But she wants to share herself with him. If you want, if any of you guys want a copy of this, I can email a PDF to you.
Please.
You know, it's a great, it's a great story.
What's the name of the other comic that you mentioned with the
alcohol? Oh, Wild Rover. It's by Michael Oeming, O-E-M-I-N-G. And it's a great story. It's really dark. It's kind of like, it looks like Tim Burton's A Nightmare Before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like extra, extra noir-y and dark.
Right.
What?
I said even more dark.
Yes. Yeah, even more dark than that. So.
I have a question. So what's the English starting with English 40?
What?
What's English starting with English 40?
They're basically the two English offerings after English 12 and 24. So certain majors have to take them. Okay, so they're literature courses. One's a short fiction class, and then the other one is, it's like a combination. It's like intro to short fiction, and it's a whole bunch of different genres in one class.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. Okay.
Gotcha. I have a question for you.
Okay.
You kind of responded to the Kamala story. Are you familiar with it?
The what?
The Kamala story. Are you familiar with this one?
I responded by saying I don't know about it.
Oh, okay. I thought you knew, like, because you, like, reacted to what she was still saying.
I
wanted to hear
it. I didn't know.
No, because she, the theme of female and girls, and not sexualized at all, by the way.
It's great.
It's nothing. Very drawn, covered.
What I have noticed is that Comic-Con is next week.
Yeah,
and what Comic-Con has done, I've noticed, like, through the last three years, I guess, it did. It had one panel about women in comics, and then the following year it had like three. One of them was specifically about women of color, and then this year there's like five.
Last year it was like three of them.
I
just thought it was interesting that Marvel had those panels and not DC.
Right, and that's what I was going to say. Actually, so consistently, the one that I went to that was like women of color in comics. There was a woman that was on that panel who did work for DC, and she was just like, "It's so hard, and they don't care, and I'm so marginalized, and I'm not allowed, and da da da." And then it's happening at Marvel.
Mm.
It's very interesting. And DC, as far as cartoons go, is the one that does that. Representation of girls and very sexualized.
It's interesting.
Well.
Marvel and DC throughout history, they always shared roles.
Right.
Like
really?
Yes. Yeah, so DC will be ahead, and then Marvel will catch on and try to outdo them, or Marvel will just be the first, and then DC will. They're always reacting to each other, but they always change the places. With who's ahead and who's
you know what it is, because it's like
I was actually going to add something to what you were saying with Marvel and DC switching back and forth. Like one of the things that DC is now leading with is the New 52, which is the reboot of the whole entire DC universe.
Especially when you have the lineage that they have.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead.
And now what Marvel has.
You know what that is.
And Marvel is doing essentially the same thing with
so,
the Secret Wars.
The storyline for Secret Wars was I don't know why they're doing it again because
nobody does.
Yeah, I don't know why they already did the Secret Wars
from 30 years.
Yeah, they did. They already did Secret Wars. I have the both of the comics, Secret Wars 1 and 2. And right now they're doing it again. I don't know why. But this time, they destroyed both universes, both the Marvel Ultimate Universe and the original Marvel Universe, and combined them all together. So basically, we have this world now where every faction of both, of the Marvel Universe, from both universes, have their own, like, in a sense, their own territory or country, if you ask. So Hulk has his whole entire country. I believe Dr. Doom is considered to be a god now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they say, like, thank Doom.
Thank Doom. And Hydra has their own
territory. It's pretty ridiculous,
Hydra has their own territory, their own country. So does AIM, and
essentially, like, all the Spider-Mans over the years, like, from different dimensions, all exist. It's extremely confusing.
It's really confusing, and, like, the only main Spider-Man who's like alive right now is Miles Morales. The Sue Storm is dead, so a lot of people died basically. So and not like as far as like what people are you know their response to these new things as far as like the New 52 and the new Marvel universe they don't like it.
It goes to like what you were saying. It's like they try and rehash these characters to try and bring in more people, but what do? You ostracize the people that already love it in the first place, and you change the foundation of what those characters stood for in the first place. So I think it's like one of the reasons why people were so pissed off about Ms. Marvel, and this connects to what you're saying too, is Ms. Marvel before this one was Carol Danvers, blonde hair, blue eyes, uber sexy,
right?
And then they replace her with that, and they're like, well, why would you do that?
And they wanted to purposefully do
so that. It connects to both of the things that you guys are trying to say.
Right, but that's interesting because what we're saying is that Marvel somewhat desexualizes and empowers with the desexualization is what we would all hope that a female character would somewhat evolve to, whereas DC, when it did the Teen Titans and Starfire suddenly became this pinup model where she was in this practically invisible bikini and only focusing on sex and, you know, and has no real emotional connections to her fellow teammates. So it's like these, let's change our characters, and they went in these opposite directions. So what we're somewhat looking at is the phrase that you were saying of like, oh, these are these heroes, like Stan Lee, is the purveyors of culture, cultural purveyors, the people that create these codes that then become normative codes and eventually translates to genre. And it is us. We are creators of culture, and also by being consumers. But and we create about being created by it. So it's interesting to see, you know, what does the industry permit? And so, I mean, I don't read those, so I don't know.
Yeah, I recommend don't. I would say look into it, but you wouldn't really like it.
The change of time just like it creates
amazing,
a
yeah. history of it, because I've done a tremendous reading of the history of these. It, they shift. They really do. As much as I can understand why you would see DC that way.
Did you say shift by being like leaders commercially or
shift in storyline, progressive thinking? That's really it's I mean, Wonder Woman. I think was it Marvel or DC? Because I'm always
DC.
Wonder Woman is DC.
I mean, that's
Donald Trump's homegirl.
Anyway, yeah, it was. Yep. Now DC created her.
I mean, she's got a very fascinating history.
Yeah, her past is very.
He was a Marvel character when she was created. Yeah. When the Museum of Sex opened up, it was the first exhibit was about.
I know she was a dominatrix character and all this, and
she would tie up her all men, that the villains.
But she still was created, and from these guys created her. And yes, she's sexy and everything, but everything she stands for, athleticism. I mean, a strong, powerful, physically developed woman, physically formed, physically worked out. I mean, what are you looking when your athletes are out there, men or women? I mean, are you kidding? You have to. They look like that. The way she, the fighting with the men, fighting against the wars, not even a question that, of course I'm going to do that. That's what I'm supposed to do.
Jane, don't be shy.
I'm working with weaponry, working physical, sports, all of that. I know she's in a sexy suit. Get past the sexy suit.
I don't think sexualization is a bad thing when it's adults.
That's what I wanted to say. Those drawings really were for the guys who are into that dominatrix world.
I would like to add.
He was. He was married to two women at this time, and he was out there.
But his girlfriend, his wife, and all the affairs,
and the children were all from her. But they all lived in the same house together. I think that's.
And then he makes this character. We all love her, but look who got to make her.
Yeah. But I don't think there's a worse Gene's life.
I know.
First, I want to say, as the dad of a 10-year-old boy who dressed up as Dora for Halloween when he was 4 and was a big-time fan for many years of Word Girl. I loved your presentation. Really. Okay. That was amazing. And one of the things I'm interested in about, I'm more of a graphic novel person than a comic, so to speak. And I was really interested, Patrick, because I never read Resident Alien. And I think one of the most interesting and painful aspects of talking about identity is the idea of passing. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with Gene Luang Yang's ABC, American-born Chinese.
It's
about a series of shape-shifting characters, like the Monkey King, etc. And it includes a shape-shifting Chinese youth who's 12 years old, who is trying to shape-shift into being a white kid so that he can be more accepted by the high school jocks, so he can be more accepted by the white girls in his neighborhood. And they're actually using this book in my 12-year-old daughter's class at school, where the majority population is Chinese, but there's a big schism going on among the students, some of whom, you know, the parents, there's a huge Chinese community in my neighborhood. And so the parents really want to say, hang on, we want you in our community to stay like that. And the kids are saying, we want to be more Americanized. And so I think this question of passing is fascinating. And I'm thinking of books like, if you've read Matt Johnson's Incognito, it's a graphic novel about a black man who can pass as white, who actually goes undercover in the Ku Klux Klan. And if it sounds like an impossible story, it's actually based on, on a story where Walter White, the ex-president of the NAACP, did something just like that to do investigative journalism about lynchings. Or there's another well-known graphic novel about, called The Photographer, which is about a photographer who goes in with Doctors Without Borders, who goes to Afghanistan and gets lost and has to pass as Muslim or he's going to get killed. Okay, and his attempts to do so are, some are funny, but more of them are really, really harrowing. So I just think that's, so I think that a book like Resident Alien and the idea of passing I think that's a very potent example of a text that we could use in all sorts of different classes about English sociology, psychology. I just think of that as a very deft book to choose.
Yeah, but you could even companion Incognito with James Bolton Johnson's Diary of an Ex-Colored Man.
Yes, and that's used in 12 and 24 all the time.
Yeah, where he passed it. Well, he's more communion-like. Whatever group he is with, he is really... he consists to be amongst that group.
Yes.
Like when he's traveling with he is Spanish. People all think of him as being Spanish. When he's with the black community, people think of him as being black. When he's with white, people think of him as being white. And there's a lot of commentary on where do I fit in? And who am I? Does my intelligence also deal with the color of my skin? At the end, he marries a white woman. And he doesn't know if his children are going to come out looking darker skinned than him, because or be able to blend in the way that that he does. But they take that chance.
Miss Marvel, she's definitely dealing with that, being in school and everything, and being different, and having very conservative parents who still want her to live by those traditions, and then going back to high school with all these other kids. And
do you keep using the classroom?
Well, I've been, right now what I'm using more than anything is just a broad overview, but I am going to be using it eventually.
And then what do? You just tell the bookstore to buy it and they buy it through the bookstore? Do you have that book at the bookstore?
No, this is the thing. So, like, I write about comic books, I review comic books, so, like, I get PDFs sent to me every week, you know?
And we don't have to worry about...
I mean, we're using it for educational purposes.
Right.
We're not selling it or anything like that, you know. So
yeah. I refer to them on my phone. Just go.
I've actually told the creator of Resident Alien that I've used it in class, and he thought it was like the coolest thing ever. Michael Oeming too.
I wonder if you told the Dark Horse.
No, I didn't tell Dark Horse. Right. But like Michael Oeming, like loves that
not
stuff.
Not that anyone should ever say.
Yeah.
No.
Just photocopy. I just not the whole.
So you do photocopies of like parts
of it while I'm telling them about it, so show them this is what was done. They like that.
So like, you just give them a PDF link.
So like I initially started using graphic novels as a way to kind of like kill off the first 2 weeks of students going, I couldn't get the book today.
Right.
And then it worked out so well that I continued to use them.
When I taught at LaGuardia, we used mouse. Mm-hmm. I was in a link class with an English professor who used mouse, and it was the first time I had read it. Mm-hmm. And of all the things that I gave them for reading, that was the one that they had read.
Mm-hmm. Mouse is often commonly used in high schools.
Sure, right? Because it's
one of these books where because I've taught mouse at least a dozen times in my English 30.
And how did
class.
You do it? You just order it through the bookstore?
Yes, that's one.
If it has an ISBN number, you could.
Yeah, that one is so easily accessible.
Right.
You can find that in any halfway decent bookstore.
Right.
Mouse One, and Mouse. There's also Meta Mouse, in which there is tons of interviews, transcripts,
mm-hmm.
Even a DVD of him speaking with his father.
Mm.
But one of the things I was going to mention is you know, a book like Mouse is, which was seen as incredibly subversive when it came out. I remember some dear friends of mine were Holocaust survivors. They've actually come to my class to speak about the book Night.
Mm.
In a course I was teaching on memoir. And when Mouse came out, I sent the book to them because we were dear, dear friends. And they mailed the book back to me that week with a note saying that this just isn't for us. And I rushed over to their house,
right,
and we had dinner, and we remained friends afterwards. But they're like, this is for your generation to write a cartoon about the Holocaust. And I'm saying, it's not quite like that. But I found when I've asked my students about it that a lot of them seem to have misread it in high school. That they thought it was like Holocaust light or something
mm-hmm.
like that, or that the author was poking fun at his father, which is sure as hell not the point of the book.
Right.
So I think you know that there's you know some graphic novels dive in on the real deep bleak end, and sometimes when you teach them in high school, they can be either too traumatic or be seen as not traumatic enough. That they're just kind of like, oh, this is kind of light, fluffy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think it's you know the matching. The text, the audience, and the expectations of a serious college mm-hmm. course is not always an easy matter.
Oh, no, please, ladies first.
Okay.
You got a class.
Yeah,
you're excused.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem. It was a pleasure, guys.
What a big thing about what you're saying is when, again, it's the